Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, a conversation with the congressman from Silicon Valley, Ro Khanna, and a conversation with Chris Matthews, the former Hardball host, has a lot to say about a lot of stuff and really enjoyed talking with him. But we start with Ro Khanna, who is one of the top leaders in Congress on the issue of artificial intelligence, as he represents all of the top companies on that issue. He's talked about or thought about as a potential presidential candidate. He's been to New Hampshire recently. He's made some waves when he made comments about Dianne Feinstein and her that she should resign, was what he said. He also talked about Gavin Newsom suggesting he may not be the strongest presidential candidate. So Ro Khanna likes to work with Republicans, go on Fox News Channel, but also has a very progressive feel, endorsing Barbara Lee, endorsing Bernie Sanders. So he's kind of unlike anybody else out there. It was the first time he's been in studio. Here's our conversation with Congressman Khanna. Ro Khanna, in the House for the first time. Congressman, good to see you. Welcome to The Issue Is.
Alex, great to be on set. As I was telling you, you've become the brand name in California now. So every California congressperson has to pay a visit.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, there's the promo. Why don't we just stop now? There's no reason to keep going. All right. Thank you for that. Nice to see you here. Let's talk about what I think is one of the most interesting issues right now. Artificial intelligence. You are the congressman representing Silicon Valley. This big question is, how do we regulate it? Can Congress even regulate this? Is the genie out of the bottle? What are your thoughts? Where are we at on that?
Well, first, let's understand what it is. It's taking a lot of big data and it's statistics that then gives you a probability of outcome. I'll make some news. I'm in the process of actually putting together a council of industry leaders, ethicists, to help inform some of the principles for the Congress. Because right now, we have a technological literacy challenge in the Congress. But then we need to look at how it can be used for positive and how we can make sure that the data sets are accurate that are being put in, that it's not misused, and needs smart regulation.
So who are you talking about on that council, and what are you going to be saying to Congress?
Well, I can't make all the news, so, but we will have a council that's going to have some of the industry leaders. It's going to have the ethicists. It's going to have a combination of think tanks and industry. And my task, I'm going to charge them with saying, look, help the United States come up with policies that are going to use the benefits of AI. Let me give you a quick example. You go to the ER, unfortunately, or someone you know goes to the ER. You have symptoms. The doctor says, here are the symptoms. What could it be? That's augmenting a doctor's ability to treat. And make sure that you have the proper regulation so it's not being abused with misinformation and all the negative things. And they're going to, I think, help inform us.
And are you suggesting that some of the 60, 70-year-old, 80-year-olds in Congress might need a little bit of education on this?
You could put it that way. I'm just saying, I don't think it's even a fully just an age thing. I think, unfortunately, Congress is not up to speed with technology. I've said every member should visit at least for a few days my district.
Right, which is the hub of so much technology. And technology is also at the heart of so many strikes that we're seeing throughout California and throughout the country. We call this the summer of strikes, hot labor summer. What do you see as the role of government in potentially ending some of these strikes?
Well, technology isn't a license for exploitation. So let's look at the writers' strike and why they're striking. When you used to have a popular show, Friends or Seinfeld, and it used to have reruns, the writers used to make money of it being popular. Now, you could have a hit like Ted Lasso, and if you're a writer for that, you don't get the residuals. You don't get anything more. And all the writers are saying is, tell us how many people are streaming it and pay us based on that. And let's not replace all entertainment with AI, because that will be the dumbing down of entertainment. I think both are very reasonable.
Do you think, like, the governor, the president, somebody should get involved to try to end this thing?
Yeah, I think the governor should. I mean, I've been out on picket lines with the actors, with some of the writers. It'd be great to see more members standing with them. It'd be great to see the governor with them. It's pretty simple that they have the right policy here. The other thing they're saying is don't automate us through technology. I mean, do you really want AI writing your scripts. I don't think that's the case. I think we want to have writers, actual human beings writing it, and you want to make sure they get paid properly.
One of the most interesting things about you is that you actually work with the other side, because so many people in Congress don't. And you go on Fox News a lot, you talk to Republicans, and one of your closest friends in Congress is Nancy Mace,
yes,
who is a Republican congresswoman. We've got a photo of her. The two of you have formed what you call the Child Care Caucus. You're trying to get some bipartisan legislation done to help people with child care issues. What specifically are you looking for, and do you have the votes to get that done?
Well, 86% of Americans think there should be some government support for child care. It's almost $10,000 a year of cost. It's almost, it used to be the cost of college education. Now college has gone much higher. So what we're saying is have some government support to make childcare more affordable. Let's have paid the childcare workers more. And let's not have this childcare cliff where at the end of September, 70,000 childcare centers may lose their funding because the funding runs out from the American Rescue Plan.
So obviously there's a Democratic Senate, there's a Republican House. What are you hearing? Are there the votes to do what you're talking about?
There's a possibility of at least avoiding the child care cliff and getting more funding for child care. I want child care $10 a day, $2,400 a year for working and middle-class families. We're not going to get that without the president and a Democratic House and Senate. But what Nancy Mace and I can do is make sure that the funding doesn't dry up and that we increase some support for families.
Another big story that we saw in Washington this week is the health of Senator Mitch McConnell, which is sad to see him freeze up. He insists that he's okay. The Capitol physician insists that he's okay, and he's going to keep in his job. But this reminded a lot of folks of Senator Dianne Feinstein and concerns about her health. You were the first and so far the only Democratic member of the House to call for her to resign. Do you stand by that now?
I do. There have been a few others. I think I may be the only one in California. Look,
so
I have
California,
a tremendous,
say, yeah,
tremendous amount of admiration and respect for Senator Feinstein. And ultimately, of course, it's her decision. And I have a respect for her staff, who's doing a tremendous job. But I said what I believe is the right thing as a California voter, and I stand by that.
What did people say to you behind the scenes when you made that comment about Feinstein?
Well, there were quite a few people who agreed, who said, you know, this is something that needs to be done. But many said, look, it's her decision ultimately, which I agree with. And I've expressed my viewpoint, but I don't want to beat a dead horse in that I have tremendous admiration for her, respect for her.
Sure.
I made my point, and now it's for her to decide.
You know, behind the scenes, there are also Democrats who quietly, not in front of the camera, express concerns about Joe Biden's age and are concerned about this concept that the president would be 86 years old at the end of his next term. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I believe he's the best candidate to win, and I think he is fully there to be able to govern. Now, to say that age is not a factor would be defying common sense. Obviously, that's one of the factors people will consider. But when they look at what he has delivered, when they look at the experience that he's had to lead on foreign policy, when they look at the fact that he is the best candidate to carry Pennsylvania, Michigan, and the Midwest, I think that the party will rally around him.
We know you were in New Hampshire recently. Should we read into that, that you may be interested someday in running for president?
I was there. I'm on the president's advisory committee, and I was there making the case for the president. If folks look at the speech, they'll see me touting President Biden's record.
You made some news this week. You were on with Hugh Hewitt on the radio.
Yes.
And he asked you about the possibility if Joe Biden wasn't running and Governor Newsom was running, you said that Newsom may not be the strongest candidate. What did you mean by that?
Well, look, I like the governor. I've supported the governor twice for his campaigns. I supported him in the recall. I think he has done some things like the manufacturing on insulin that is to be applauded. All I meant was it's premature. I mean, Hewitt was basically thinking that there was going to be some conspiracy on our side to supplant Biden with Governor Newsom. And I don't think Governor Newsom believes that. And, of course, all I was saying is it's going to be an open, competitive primary. We've got a lot of talent. But I have a lot of respect for the governor.
But do you think some of the Midwestern governors, like Josh Shapiro, I think you mentioned, might be stronger in the middle of the country?
Well, who knows? Look, no one would have predicted Obama. No one would have predicted Donald Trump. Right. Probably people wouldn't have predicted Biden. So I just think whoever, here's what I know, whoever the pundits are saying is going to win, probably it's someone else. And it's going to be an open field, but the governor will be, California's governor, if he chooses to run, would be one of the strong contenders.
Of course, he says he never, ever has even thought about running for president.
Every person who has run for dog catcher has thought of being president of the United States.
Okay, well,
there you go.
There's an honest answer from you, and that would, I guess, include you as well. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about you, because maybe you will run for president one day. This is a really interesting story, though. Let's take a look at a picture of your grandfather and you. And your grandfather, remarkable man, served in behind bars with Mahatma Gandhi in India. And you recently led a congressional delegation to India. Can you describe the emotions of what that must have felt like for you and to be thinking about your grandfather there?
Well, it was an incredible moment. I'm the co-chair of the India Caucus. I got to lead with 8 members of Congress, and we were there on India's Independence Day, August 15th. And of course, my grandfather had been in jail twice in the 1930s and 1940s, fighting for India's independence. And I thought, wow, what a moment. You know, Alex, when my parents came to this country, they would not have been able to get a meeting with a staff member to a member of Congress. Today, we've got 5 South Asians in Congress. When people talk about the country and the lack of hope, I say, look at the Congress and the young people being elected. It gives me so much hope in the future of this nation.
What was the most important lesson you learned from your grandfather?
You know, he had a view on the nobility of politics, the sense that, I mean, he spent 15 years in this freedom movement. He was there with Gandhi, with Nehru, and they changed the destiny of a people. And that's what I grew up with. You know, I was in Massachusetts recently, and this may sound quaint, but someone said to me that for him, Michael Dukakis was what John F. Kennedy was for the country. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, Michael Dukakis believed in the nobility of public service. And there was a time, even George Bush Sr., where there was this sense that you go into politics and public service. When I talk to young people, it's the one thing I try to convey. Don't just think everyone is corrupt. Don't just think all the institutions are broken. There is still a nobility to American politics. And that was what ultimately my grandfather taught me about politics.
For viewers here in Los Angeles, they will, of course, recognize the former mayor of Los Angeles is now the ambassador to India. Not easy for him to get that job. Now he's there.
Doing a fabulous job.
What was that like? Tell us about how Eric Garcetti's doing and seeing him up close. What was that like?
Well, I went to Indian Independence Day in a suit and jacket, and there is Garcetti, our ambassador, in the Nehru jacket. And I said, Eric, you got it. I mean, he is friends with all of the Indian government officials. He's treading the line between the strategic relationship and pluralism. He's doing a fabulous job. I'm so proud of the president for putting in there. I'm proud of him for persevering through the Washington process. He's making a difference.
You know, we like to play music on this show. So last time you were on, you said Bruce Springsteen was your favorite artist.
Yes.
He's my favorite artist. But I asked about what's your favorite song of all time.
Right.
And you chose Ebony and Ivory.
I got so much heat for that in high school, but I'm sticking with it. Now that I'm in Congress, they used to say it's sappy, it's saccharine, you know, it's got, you know, there goes Ro again with Ebony and Ivory. All my high school friends used to give me a hard time for this. But I'm sticking to it.
What is it about that song?
Well, one, I just like the melody.
Yeah.
Two, if you remember, it was the only song that was banned in South Africa during apartheid for Paul McCartney. And it's a great song about simply people coming together and living in aspirational, a bit utopian. But I like it.
Our thanks to Ro Khanna. Now to a conversation with one of my favorites growing up, Chris Matthews. This was a real treat. And as you can imagine, Chris likes to talk. So a lot of this we had to cut from the TV version, but here on the podcast version, you get the full thing. Here is Chris Matthews in all of his glory. But we begin with some sound from Gavin Newsom this week on Meet the Press.
Filing deadlines haven't passed. President Biden doesn't run. Why shouldn't we consider you a likely candidate?
Well, I think the vice president is naturally the one lined up, and the filing deadlines are quickly coming to pass. And I think we need to move past this notion that he's not going to run. President Biden is going to run, and looking forward to getting him reelected.
Governor Newsom on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd this weekend, expressing support for President Biden and, notably, for Vice President Harris. But there have been a series of tough polls for President Biden. 67% of Democrats telling CNN they want a different nominee other than Joe Biden. Their biggest concern? His age. Recent poll from the Wall Street Journal shows 73% of Americans say the president is too old to run for re-election. Joining us now to discuss this and more is author and political commentator Chris Matthews. Welcome to The Issue Is.
Morning. It's great to be here out west. I'm in Los Angeles.
Yes. You're joining us from Nantucket. We like seeing relaxed Chris. And if you give me a
yes,
moment.
Yes, it is very relaxed up here.
I'm gonna fanboy for 1 second. You are one of the main reasons I got into this business. I watch Hardball every day, the Chris Matthews Show every weekend. Here are some of the books that I have wrote.
I like
so
it.
Thank you for the Simon inspiration, including Hardball, the best. And so thank it you. Means so much to have you on this show. Thank you for everything.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right, so let's talk about President Biden. And when you look at those numbers, which are not good, should the Democrats actually be looking at a different nominee? Would somebody else potentially be stronger?
Well, right now, I think as ironic as everything is in 2023, in September, Trump looks strong. And Trump would probably beat, unless somebody really got their act going, anybody else but Biden. Biden has incumbency. He has a pretty good economy on demand in terms of jobs. Difficult with regard to inflation, of course. In fact, inflation will be in the headline if he loses. That's what I can tell you right now. If he loses to Trump, it'll say inflation did it to him. I think it should be up for grabs. Normally, I would think that Biden would have taken a number of public steps right now. I remember Nixon back in 71 when he's looking forward to a tough race with Muskie before they got rid of him and made sure they had McGovern as an opponent. That he did a whole new wage price freeze. He did that, opened up the gold window. He brought in John Connolly as his Treasury Secretary. He really strengthened his whole program coming into the election, in addition to going to China and bringing a deal with the Soviet Union. So he did a lot of steps. I'm not sure Biden's taking a number of steps. I'm not seeing the bulwark being really put up there to get reelected in the way he should, because this is going to be a very, very tricky election, and he could easily lose this election. Very close right now. Pennsylvania, if the country's even, Pennsylvania's lost. Those states in the middle, Trump won by, he lost by 7 million votes in 20, but he lost those states. And it's just very hard to see when if it's 46%, that's all Trump had in 2016. He had 46%. So it's enough to win right now already. So I think he should be making efforts to prevent this. And as for Gavin Newsom, he reminds me of a guy in the on-deck circle in a baseball game. He's like Hillary Clinton with Pat Monahan, or let's see, Cory Booker with Frank Lautenberg. They're in the on-deck circle swinging their bat, but unless they go to the plate and make it a little more difficult for the guy at the plate, they're not going to get the bat. And that's what they got to think about this. And this thing about pushing Kamala Harris, well, that's nice. That's appropriate. She is VP. But does he want to be president? And he doesn't sound like he wants to be if he doesn't say, I want to be president. You don't wonder about who's running against you or who you think deserves it or all that. You say, do I want to be president? Then I have to run. That's how it works. So I don't really believe Gavin Newsom. I just don't believe what he said. He's obviously counting on Biden running again. He doesn't want to disturb issues with the Black community. And I understand that completely. And it is her turn, you could argue. But vice presidents don't get to be president automatically. That's not how it works. That's not the way our system works.
When you say that Biden needs to be doing other moves, what would you suggest him do?
I would bring in a very strong Secretary of the Treasury who can get on television a week on Meet the Press every Sunday and every one of the talk shows and be very strong on the economy with a recognized economic background. Someone who people trust on the economy. One of the tech people that really are trusted. When you hear them talk like Buffett or somebody, you go, yeah, I've been betting on him for years. You know, I would trust his word. Biden is not known as an economist. And even though there's some strong demand out there and we have a very good GDP, we have inflation. And there has to be some confidence it's going to come down. And that means, like Nixon had John Connolly, a strong voice. I think that's very important. And there's nobody. The key is not taking advantage of his cabinet. I don't hear from the cabinet on Sunday talk shows. I don't hear them. Where are they? Why aren't they talking up the economy? Why is it only him doing the economy? Why? You know, he doesn't have a vice president who will talk on the economy. He doesn't have a cabinet that talks on the economy. He's out there all alone. And that makes – he looks weak because he's all alone. If you're the only person saying the economy is in good shape, you're not going to be believed. It's just not – he's not building up a strong offense is what I'm saying.
And in terms of Newsom, do you think
– And by the way, Kamala could be doing so much better for herself. I have never met – and I've met her in the back room when you can meet – actually talk casually with a politician. And you all know they're different when they get in the back room or in the green room or whatever. And they talk with a natural conversational voice. She's very likable and thoughtful. And she speculates and she thinks. I think she talks too much as a prosecutor, not as a person telling her story. What was it like growing up with an Indian mother, with a tiger mother? What was that like? What was it like having a father from the Caribbean? What was that like? What was it like? What was about your decision to go to Howard University? That was a very strong statement to join the Black culture in a sense and say, I'm running as a Black woman. Talk about that. Talk about how you sort of oriented yourself socially and politically and why you did that. And tell us more about yourself. And people would come there and say, yeah, I can't imagine living like that, but I get it. I think I know what she's been through. Talk in a way that makes people want to be compassionate toward you. It is so basic, the politics. And I don't know how she's come this far from district attorney to attorney general to U.S. senator to U.S. vice president without at least beginning to do that.
She
got on the ticket by kneecapping Joe Biden on the busing issue. Well, that may be one way to get to the vice presidency, but it doesn't make you likable. That's just one way to win. It worked.
Yeah, like I interviewed her dozens of times, and then she hasn't come on this show or almost any of these kinds of shows for over 3 years. Why do you think she's not making that argument? I mean, we've invited her to do that, and she doesn't come on.
Well, either the staff don't stand up to her, and I know that's tricky with a person that could be perhaps that's tricky to do because they'll say, look how far I've come. What do you know? You didn't come this far. What are you telling me what to do? But, you know, I worked for Tip O'Neill for 6 years, and he had a problem because he wasn't used to television, and he wasn't used to dealing with Reagan, who's a superstar on television. And I just worked with him, and it worked. And people ended up deciding 65% loved Tip when he left office. I mean, people came to like him, said, this guy, big overweight guy. He cares about the little people. He cares about the people he's from. He's not from Harvard. He's a regular guy, and I know what he's doing. I know why he's there. You know what I mean? Why are you there is the great question of politics. Why are you and not me there? Tell me why you're there. Is it just to get tough on people who are pro-life? There's nothing wrong with people who are pro-life. They just disagree with you. They have a different philosophy. They're not the enemy. You have to make your case for liberty and freedom for women. It's so much, it makes you likable.
Right.
If I got in the back room with her, I'd say, give me 10 minutes and I'll make my spiel. But I'm going to make a case for you to be likable. And then sooner or later, if you do get to be president, you'll want to be liked. And it's not that hard. People do have a big heart for people who have had it more difficult than they have.
Sure. Of course, you wrote about Tip O'Neill and Tip and the Gipper. You've written extensively about Bobby Kennedy, one of your heroes. Here's the book.
I'm going to put
it up on the screen as well. This book is called Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. Of course, his son is running for president, RFK Jr., who's going to be on our show next week. What do you think that Bobby would make of RFK Jr.'s run?
Well, that's a totally unfair question. So.
Yeah. Well, what do you make? What do you make of? What do you make of RFK Jr.?
I'll tell you what I think. My book on Bobby sold the most of any books I ever wrote. It caught, because for people a little younger than me, he was their Kennedy. He had heart. He was the one, you know, who really had a heart for people who were in trouble. He was the likable one. Jack could be very cold at many times, and Jack was the one with heart. And I think the family really liked the book. I mean, Ethel helped me with the book. His wife helped me with it. And Kathleen, his oldest daughter. And I think they'd all liked it. So I think we agree on Bobby Kennedy. I knew Bobby Jr. back when he was an environmentalist, and he was with Riverkeepers from cleaning up the Hudson River and And he told me at the time he was going to stay away from electoral politics because he didn't want to do everything. He just wanted to do what he was good at. I think what he's good at, which is certainly the environment and clean water. And I think he should have stayed with that. I mean, that's a great issue. It's become a bigger issue than even when we talked about it back then. It's the environment now. It's climate. Look at the heat levels we're living in. I think he should have stayed there, damn it. And I think he should have gone after Fauci. I like Fauci. He went to my college. And he's a good guy. He's a public servant. He never made any big money. Why are you accusing him of not being good? How many people have devoted their life to fighting HIV and AIDS and all that stuff? That's what he's done. He's been a warrior on good things. And writing a book about Fauci, and then I don't get it. I honestly don't get it. I could say it's a reach for success, but he already has that. People will listen to him no matter what he says. And I think his father took a courageous stand, first of all, against Gene McCarthy, but also against LBJ. And he knew how difficult it was. He took risks. One thing about the Kennedys that I've noticed over the years is they do take risks. We were down in Baja, California with Bobby Jr. And I remember we got stopped because our plane was running out of gas, a private plane. And we were working against the Japanese in a desalination operation down there, which we won on. And this is the National Defense or National Resource Development Fund. And he went running off into the distance to find the guy who's got pumped gas for us. And you know, he also that night before took a sombrero off a guy's hat and started passing it around to raise money for the guy who was entertaining us that night with really folk music. And so he does have guts. I don't get this one. I don't get it.
Yeah. And of course, some of the risks that the Kennedy family has taken have not turned out for them. You think about John Kennedy Jr.
Playing football on a ski slope.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Stuff that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And by the way, Bobby took risk in the way he waded through the crowds in Los Angeles in that great 68 campaign. And he really did expose himself to the public. And he got, you know, Sirhan, who's still in prison, disagree with him on the Middle East. He's a Catholic from Palestinian rights. You know, I know the whole thing. I don't get this. I wish Bobby Jr. would change and not run again. But he'll do well in New Hampshire because they're probably really mad at Biden for bringing the South Carolina prominent. And they'll say, first of all, they took away the shoe industry. Then they took away the textile industry. They took it all south, and now they're taking our primary away from us. I can make the ad. I mean,
right. It could be a good one. They're trying to switch the primary date from New Hampshire to South Carolina. All right, let's talk about the Republicans. Donald Trump continues to dominate in the polls, even though new polls this week showed that other candidates like Nikki Haley would actually do better against Joe Biden. Can Donald Trump be stopped in the GOP primary?
Well, I think the court tests will all come afterwards. I think we'll have a vote in the Iowa caucuses, which will be very early. And then we'll have the New Hampshire primary. All that's in February. So we're not going to have any action on the criminal trials till March. By the way, I'm just looking at that mugshot. I think that was an advertisement for Trump, and I don't know why, but it was. I just saw the movie again, Taken. Remember the Liam Neeson movie? Did you see it?
Yeah.
Well, it's all about a guy who basically he's basically doing it himself. He goes back and saves his daughter from Albanians and from Arabs over in Europe, and they took her away to use her, and he did it all himself. He took on the French and the corrupt French that he found. It's all about defiance and anger against the system. And that's what I think this election's about. I mean, I think if there's a mood out there in Western Pennsylvania, or in South Philly, or in Northeast Philly, the Irish guys who are on the police department or the Italian guys in South Philly. I'm just thinking about who very locally in Philly is for Trump. It's defiance against the system, against the elite, against the people who went to Ivy League schools, people that think they're better than us. I think there's so much of that, and it's been well-earned by the elite, and it's the manner in which people do look down on other people who didn't go to college. And it's for real. And that big part of it is for real. And it's not so much in California or in New York, but it's definitely in Western Pennsylvania, Ohio. You get in that area. It'll probably permeate because of inflation down into Arizona, where people are living on fixed incomes. I just don't think people like inflation.
Yeah.
But it's also they don't like the elite. And they see it. Even in Biden, they see it. And I don't see any elitism in Biden at all. Not I felt when he was nominated for vice president by Barack Obama. I mean, I was emotional about that. I said, finally, a regular Catholic, regular guy. And I said, but finally, a regular person has been nominated from where I grew up. And I thought he's for real. I think Biden is a real person. I think he is 80 years old, and that's a fact. And people have to make it. They never thought Pelosi was too old, though. Did you notice? It's interesting how that thing works. Or they don't think that Joe Manchin's too old. He's 76.
Yeah. Although Pelosi didn't have to run nationwide. She just had to run amongst her caucus. It's different when you've got a national election.
Well, that's true. In fact, in a parliamentary, you're so astute.
Right.
Because in a parliamentary system, we would have a different government.
We would have had a female president a long time ago. And that's in a parliamentary system.
Well, that's they would have worked their way through the cabinet. You're right.
Right. Speaking of elitism, let's talk about the Hardball College Tour. So it has been fun.
Well, that was something.
It was fun to see some of these old picks from the Hardball College Tour making the rounds online. Here is me on the campus of USC. You also did a lot at Harvard, the most elite of all places.
There you are.
Yeah, there I am. A young Pete Buttigieg asking a question here, who, of course, is now the transportation secretary. We've got Vivek Ramaswamy at Harvard. He's now a Republican presidential candidate. What goes through your mind when you see these images of all these people that you influenced who are now, you know, among the top leaders in the country?
Like yourself. Well, I'll tell you, what I do impress by how it makes it mean a whole era has transpired during the time these people have gone ahead. They've come from being college students to being local mayors, to being tech geniuses. You yourself on the media, you've all created careers on your own. And maybe you were stimulated by reading what I've written or what I was showing. But I really did the college tour for that reason. I had a lot of money because of NBC. We were able to go to Harvard and put every one of the Democratic candidates who were running for president in 2004 on television, Reverend now, all those guys. And we knew we were taking this story, the political story, to the campus. We knew that we took the campus, we took the story to the campus, not the campus to us. We went to them. And it was so exciting to be at places like Villanova University, where we had the biggest crowd that John McCain ever had. And we had the school bands. We always had the school band playing. You remember the rah-rah part?
Yeah.
It was a lot of rah-rah, a lot of excitement about the band and everything exciting. It wasn't that we just came in and were intellectual. We brought the fun of politics to the campus. That's what I'm glad I could do there.
When Pete Buttigieg was running for president, we set up an event at USC inspired by the Hardball College Tour and did a back and forth with people to try to imitate what you did, both of us from that next generation. Yeah. We want to have more with Chris after this. We'll have you tell me something I don't know, which is your old bit.
Oh, God.
But we go to break with one of the greatest clips in the history of cable news when an annoyed Senator Zell Miller said this to Chris.
I wish we lived in the day where you could challenge a person to a duel. Now that would be pretty good.
Norah O'Donnell, tell me something I don't know.
Chris Matthews used to ask his guests on The Chris Matthews Show and Hardball to tell me something I don't know, scoops and predictions from his panelists. Well, Chris is back with us. So, Chris, let's flip the script. Chris Matthews, tell me something I don't know.
Okay, Trump's going to name the governor of South Dakota as his running mate.
That would be Kristi Noem, who has been talked about a lot, and you think that she will be the running mate. Why?
He doesn't want any trouble from anybody. He wants somebody who's with him from the beginning. He's never always constant. He doesn't want to have somebody that might have a different opinion, like Nikki Haley. He doesn't want to have any arguments. He wants somebody who's with him. And by the way, willing to sign that January 6th approval that he got. No, he can't run. I'm sorry, he can't run again. But good.
Yeah. And part of the advantage of her, if you're thinking about TV, having a attractive younger woman next to you makes you look younger, as compared to having a younger man next to you may make you look older. Not that
you're
Trump
so
is
smart
thinking about TV producing
at all. You are so smart. Remember how Dan Quayle made George Herbert Walker Bush look really smart? and deliberate.
Yeah, Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris looked like Joe Biden's co-anchor instead of if he would have picked Pete Buttigieg, he would have looked like his grandson. Okay, not that Trump ever thinks like a TV producer.
Christy, no, we got it. We nailed it.
We play a game called Personal Issues on our show. This is 30 seconds, rapid fire questions to get to know you. This is the first thing that comes to your mind about some of your cultural favorites, because we know as much as you love politics, you may love movies just as much. So, Chris, what is your favorite movie of all time?
Lawrence of Arabia.
What is the favorite movie you've watched recently?
Taken, Liam Neeson. Good.
Favorite TV show you recently binged?
Definitely binging Downton Abbey. I am still binging it again. I do it every summer.
Best book I love it. You recently read?
Actually, I'm reading a book by a guy who was in the Peace Corps with me, and Ron Pierce wrote it, and it's the best book I've read in a long time, and I'm just looking at the manuscript. It's fabulous. But normally, I would like The Fountainhead. I like The Fountainhead. I like Gatsby. I like the basics, you know. The odds, the favorite ones.
Very nice.
Our thanks to Chris Matthews. Our thanks to Congressman Ro Khanna. Our thanks to you for listening. Next week on The Issue Is, we got two different presidential candidates. On the Democratic side, Robert Kennedy Jr. is going to be with us. On the Republican side, Doug Burgum, the governor of North Dakota, will be here. Both of them in Los Angeles next week. Really looking forward to that. I hope that you enjoyed this show. If you like it, rate us, subscribe, tell people about it, send me a note in social media. I really appreciate all of that. In the meantime, I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week.